About the Navi establishes for himself and for others that he is truly a Navi. Because it's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to listen to the words of the Navi, right? Or also, the Navi himself is obligated to listen to that which God commands him to do. As you see in the case of Abraham, when he was prepared to sacrifice his own son. Anyways, so the question is, what is the basis upon which the Navi establishes itself? And you have the seventh parak, you have Allah of seven, that's number, that's Zion, right? Let's go through that quickly. It summarizes some of the ideas that we've already taken up, and he brings in some new stuff. He says, Hanavi, after Shakiyah Nevoroso, the Atma Bulbad, it's possible that his Nevor will be for himself alone. The heart of Libo, to extend his mind, improve his mind. With the heart of Dago, to increase his knowledge. But Lev usually is also a euphemism for the mind, yeah. No, I really don't think so, because the heart of Levo, that God should give us a lave nechon. The Torah does refer to the lave as being also the seat of knowledge. In other words, lave, the term lave can refer to the emotions. Sometimes it's used to refer to the emotions. Interestingly enough, I mean, I'm not going to deny your point. Your point has validity. That the lev can refer to the emotion. You see that, for example, in the midst of tefillin. The tefillin shall yad, the tefillin shall rosh. All right, the tefillin shall rosh is on the head. That represents that the mind is in line with reality, true ideas. Right. Now the tefillin shall yad, interestingly enough, in other words, where does it have to be? It has to be on that part of the arm which is opposite the heart. So really, it's not the arm so much. It's not so much the arm, or it's not exclusively the arm. There's a reason why it's on the arm, but it's also opposite the heart. And that represents the other aspect, the perfection of the emotion. So tefillin, the mitzvah tefillin really represents the perfection of the individual. Now the perfection of the individual consists of what? Consists of two things. That the person has true ideas, but it's not enough just to have true ideas in an abstract sense, but that he's incorporated these ideas into his emotions. In other words, his emotions are in line. All of his emotional energy is in line with his knowledge. Right? In that sense, the lave represents the emotion. But the term lave is also used to denote the knowledge as well. Now, you have a valid point here. You have a valid point because I'm saying that Laharthas, to extend Libo, his heart, the Ram is not referring to the emotion. Ulahosif Dato, and to increase his knowledge. Yeah, but according to me, it's redundant then. It's repetitive. So according to you, how do you understand it? Yeah, but the word Laharthiv doesn't mean perfect. Laharthiv is to expand, to make it wider, to broaden. Now, what is... So I'll ask, I mean, I have to justify it, and you have to justify it. Now, point to you, what do you mean to broaden his emotion? What is the point of broadening one's emotion?
Sorry, Anthony.
What I've even wanted to say is that the broadening of the emotions that we're talking about is to give a deeper content to the emotions. That's what you want to say. That, in other words, right? In other words, once you add knowledge, so your emotions become different. They become more profound. They're different kinds. That's a valid idea. The only thing is, All right, I'll accept that, but I have a different interpretation. I'm saying laharchiv libo. Libo, I'm saying, refers to his mind in this sense. It refers to his mind. Now, when a person makes an advance, an intellectual advance, then two things occur. First of all, the instrument itself is broadened. The capacity of the mind, you're not the same type of a thinker. In other words, as you progress in thinking, it's not just that you gain quantitatively, but the whole thinking methodology changes. You broaden, you become a broader thinker, which means to say that if you advance in knowledge, you compare your current thinking to your past thinking, you'll see that your past thinking is not as multidimensional. In other words, it's more simplistic. You tend to look, when a person starts out, you tend to look at a problem in a simpler way. And even as you advance, you gain more tools of analysis. So you begin to broaden. Now when a problem arises, you can look at it from more angles. Of course, as your mind improves, so then there's a deeper quality to it. I think that's what he means. Lahachiv libo is the improvement of the mind. There are certain types of insights which improve the mind. You see? In other words, when you learn an idea, it could have two possible effects. A, your mind is the same way as it was before. You just picked up a new idea that you didn't know about before. But your mind is no different than it was before. B, there are certain kind of ideas that open up your mind. Ah, now I see a whole new way of thinking. It adds a new dimension to your whole thinking apparatus. Yeah, logics can help you with that. Exactly. So I think that's my interpretation of the Rambam. I disagree with Aviva and Lori on this. Although you have a right to maintain your idea. I just disagree, and I think the Rambam is saying that the objective of a nevuah, and this is a very important idea, that if the objective of a nevuah can be purely for the sake of the Navi himself, having no purpose outside of the Navi, it's an end in itself. Which, by the way, I think is a very, interestingly enough, if you were at the Sunday Shir, I don't think too many people there were at the Sunday Shir. But, yes. But if you remember, Rachet discussed the idea of two kinds of purpose. That, in one sense, if he was saying that the purpose of the Torah, the purpose of the knowledge of the Torah, is simply that man should have this knowledge. And you can't ask, well, what's the purpose of man having this knowledge? That's the purpose. It's an end in itself. The knowledge from man is an end in itself. If they're like, I mean, the world is looking this way. The world is always saying, what are you studying for? What are you going to do with it? Right? Because they can't understand that knowledge can be an end in itself. So they have to find some other, either you're teaching, or you're going to make money out of it, or you're going to help the world, but something which they can view as a purpose. But we don't hold that way. We say that no. That a person should have ideas. Of course, we have an obligation to help others, but that the person should have knowledge, that's an end in itself. So I think that it's very interesting. You see that this fits in with the whole concept of nevuah. That the phenomenon of nevuah is rooted not just in the idea that God wants to convey information for the benefit of mankind, but simply for man's intellectual perfection. So you see that man's intellectual perfection is a purpose of the creation. It's an end in itself. That's what they're on. The thing, lahachiv libo, I'm taking leg here to refer to the mind. Ulahosa dato means increasing his knowledge. You understand the difference between the two? One is improving the faculty, expanding the powers of the mind, and the second one is simply to increase knowledge in areas which he would not have had without nevuah. And this is a purely personal phenomenon. Until he knows, achayeda mashaloha yodea, until he acquires knowledge of that which he lacked, in other words, certain areas of metaphysics which were closed off to him in the ordinary state, but now in the prophetic state he gains new information which he could not have otherwise gained. Then he says, that's the first objective that he mentions. Then he says, it is also possible that he should be sent to a nation of the nations, or to the people of a city, or a kingdom, to teach them, or to let them know what they should do, or to prevent them from the evil actions that they're doing. Every famous case, of course, comes to mind, the case of Yonah.
the case you read about on Yom Kippur.
So that's also possible, but that's not the essence of Nevuah necessarily. But God can utilize the channel of Nevuah for this purpose. Then he says, now here's where this is the issue that I want to get into. This is a very, very big issue, a big machlokus I discovered between the Rambam and Sadi Gaon. So we'll see if we can get into that issue tonight. We just get started on that. He says, "Ukeshiva shalchen oso," and when he is sent, when they send him, of course, when God sends him, "Nosdim lo osu mofes," they give him a sign and a wonder. Okay, so here the Rambam is dealing with the issue, right? If you're going to send the prophet, if someone's going to speak in the name of God, he's certainly going to be required to give some kind of proof. The Rambam here mentions a sign and a wonder, without telling us what that is. It would appear from this that the Rambam holds something out of the ordinary, some supernatural type of phenomenon. So that the nation should know that God sent them in truth. Alright? Then he goes on and he says, "Velo kola osa osu mofes ma'aminim lo." But not everybody that performs a sign and a wonder do we believe shu navi. What does that mean? In other words, the sign and the wonder is not enough. Ela adam sheyinu yodim ba mitchila shu roi lanavua. But only a person whom we knew about from the beginning, that he is fit for prophecy, b'chachmaso, with his chachma, his knowledge, u'b'maso, and his action. Okay, because he has to be a perfected individual. Shenis alabahen, that he has arisen, has risen to a high level with them, al kol b'nei agilo, of all the people of his group. Right. And he is going in the ways of prophecy, b'kti shasa, in its holiness, uvepri shusa, and its separateness. In other words, as the Rambam said before, that he's a poresh, he's someone who is totally different in all of his ways. Then the achkach ba, then he came, the asa osu mofes, and he performed a sign and a wonder. The amar shehakel shalacho, and he said that God has sent him, mitzvah l'shmo mimenu. It is a mitzvah to listen to him. Shenemar, as it says, Elov Tishmon, unto him shall you listen. So what is the Rambam saying? If that's the case, so what, how would you explain it? I mean, what is the role then of the osu mofes? You have to have an osu or a mofes, right? But if you just have an osu or a mofes, it wouldn't make you into a navi. So how would you formulate that? What's the formula? Yes, Lord? Okay, I think what the Rambam is saying now will fit into the position that he established before. And that is that there are two factors in the Navi. There is the person himself. That is to say that the person, not anybody, can be a prophet. The person has to be on the level of prophecy. Well, we said before that, according to the Rambam, a person can be on the level of prophecy and still not actually achieve a prophecy. Because as we said, that God, right, God exercises a veto power, and God can prevent this person from actually prophesying. So therefore, in order to know whether a person is a prophet or not, we really have to know two things. We have to know this Gavra. Is this Gavra? Is he qualified? If he's not qualified, then that's it. There's no need. There's no need to go. Now, even if he should perform all kinds of miracles, but the Rambam said it doesn't make any difference, because that's an impossibility. Remember when he said before, it is just as impossible that a person who has no knowledge and is not prepared, that he shall prophesy as that a frog would prophesy. Those are the exact words of the Rambam in the Mora. Correct? So therefore the first level of validation is in the person himself. Then once we've established that this person is an individual who is fit to be a prophet, then the question is, but did he in fact prophesy or not? Because not everyone who is fit actually prophesies. So this, we have to have an indication that he has not just that he's fit, but that he's prophesied. That's from the sign. That's the role of the oath and the mofet. That's why both are true. You see? And of course, that's why a person is absurd. The whole idea that that Jesus would be a prophet, it's irrelevant. I mean, he didn't perform any miracles. But even if those who claim that he did or didn't, it's completely absurd, because he's not an 11. He's not an individual who achieved the level where he could even be a prophet. he wasn't a particularly learned person. He was playing, you know, basically ignorant individual. He was far from being learned in Torah. He certainly wasn't a master of all the sciences and all the areas that they have to be a master of. So of course he's rejected. You see, it's not, you don't even have to get into the whole discussion of whether he performed miracles. That's totally irrelevant. As I said, that if an individual, we should not be overcome by this type of thing. If an individual were to come along, and not that I know that it's ever occurring, but even if it should occur, and do actions, perform actions which would seem to be miraculous and beyond nature, and we tested him and we saw that he didn't have the qualifications, we would not listen to him. A person's, and you'll soon find out, we'll soon find out why, a person's emuna should never be affected by this type of thing. You see, I mean, it's a big thing today to win over people, like to have these faith healers all over, I mean, like the guy, and then these evangelists and so forth, and they all claim these tremendous miracles. Well, first of all, they're totally unsubstantiated. You know, they're afraid to bring them out, it's all the darkness, they're afraid to bring it in the light of day. But even if there should be something that you could not account for, so what? It means nothing. Okay, what was the famous case in the Torah from which we proved that an individual can have the qualifications can be the case of Yaakov, that Yaakov said, I will gather around my children, I will tell you what will occur to you, Yaakov. And he lost it. Nistalka Menashina. Because God did not want, God decided that that information would not be beneficial for to be revealed. In terms of his natural abilities, he was on that level where he was ready to have an insight into this area. So he was ready to talk about the subject. For example, let's say a person is working on a problem, and he's gone through all the steps, and he's got the whole thing set up, he's about to have that insight, and he has the full capacity to have that insight, and then God clouds up his mind, because God does not want to see it. I don't know, I hear your question, but I wouldn't learn it that way. I would learn it a good way. Now the Rambam adds something. And he says, the Efshishiyasa Osa Mofes, it is possible that he does perform an Osa and a Mofes, the Eno Navi. And he's still not a Navi. In reality. Vizeho Os, Yeshlo Dvarim Bago. And this Os has certain hidden things to it. In other words, how did he perform it? We don't know. I mean, certain people, it could be through the very, very sleight of hand, or illusions, and so forth. We don't know, yeah. It doesn't mean to say that a fundamental idea of the Rambam, that but you'll see later on, the Rambam holds that our ultimate proof, the ultimate foundation for our belief in Torah is not miracles. Because even the most wondrous miracles, the splitting of the Red Sea, they all are not absolute proofs, he holds. The Rambam has a completely different approach to this area. The Rambam says that there is no single sign or mofes that is absolutely 100% beyond question. Nevertheless, he says, I'm thinking a mitzvah l'shma, well, that's a mitzvah to listen to him. That's God's, God has determined that when a person has the requirements and he performs the sign, we have to listen to mitzvah. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's objectively true. How will the Adam Gadol? Since, remember why? Because he's an Adam Gadol, he's a great person, v'chacham, and he's a chacham, v'royal in a v'uhu, and he's fit for a v'uhu. Ma'amidim oso al-chaskasa. We establish him, we maintain him on his chazaka, his status. He has a certain status, and that's what we do. Shebekach nistavinu, he says, for this is, we were commanded in this, k'mosh nistavinu lachto chesadin, you see, he brings a beautiful analogy. He says, just like we were commanded to decide the law of Pishnei Edim Kshayim on the basis of two kosher witnesses. Before I explain it, what does he mean over here? Can you anticipate the Rambam? The Rambam is saying that we listen to the Navi, right, who has established his credentials and performed the signs, right, even though the signs could have some trick to them, some secret that we don't know. In the same way that we are commanded to Paskin and Shaila, or then, on the basis of two kosher witnesses. What's the connection? What's he saying? Laurie? In other words, they're Edim Kesherim. That means that we've tested them, and they have all the requirements, but how do you know they're not lying? Do you mean to, and by the way, we can execute a person on the basis of the testimony of two witnesses after they've been severely interrogated and so forth, but if we can't break them down, then we go ahead and we execute a person. Now, isn't it possible that these people decided for whatever reason to get even with this individual, and they worked at brilliant people, they worked at a story, and they can't be... You don't know. Do you know that it's true? The answer is no. The reason why we listen to two witnesses and we execute an individual is not because since two witnesses tell it and they're kosher, it must be true. We don't know. In reality, we do it because that God set up a system, a judicial system, and in that judicial system, He laid down the parameters, and the parameters to follow two witnesses, provided that they correspond to everything that's required of witnesses. Oh, then the Rambam says the same is true with regard to a Navi. A Navi is also has to fit in somewhere in the halachic system. So when we finally do listen to him, it's not because it is something unique or separate here, it's simply because he occupies a place in the Torah. The Torah has told us that there is a phenomenon of a Navi, and once he passes the test of Nevuah, right, according to the way we see it, we have to listen to him. In reality, it could be that he faked us out. The Rambam is saying it's not because absolutely it must be that there's no other explanation but that it comes from God. No, that's not the ultimate thing. I'm stressing this because I want you to bear in mind when we turn to the position of Sadia. Sadia seems a different approach. Now let me finish up this halacha. And he says, the afapisha efshir sheheidu b'sheker. He says, we listen to these Edom, even though it is possible that they're testifying falsely. So if it's possible they're testifying falsely, docking and attacking to kill a person, it's a suffix, you can't execute a person that way. The answer is, holel uksherimim etlenu. Since they are kosher as far as we're concerned, so that's called a chazaka. They have a certain status of being shared. Ma'amidim osam al kashrusam. We retain them, we maintain them in their kosher status. Now, uvadvar me'elu, concerning these types of things, in other words, you want to know why it is that way? Ukayotiv ben nemar, it says, hanistar tvar Hashem elokeinu. The hidden things are to the Lord our God. Vaniglos lanu v'neinu. Then, in other words, that is the wisdom of God. You can't ask why God decided that we should follow Edom. You can give explanations if you want. You can show benefits out of having the system, but you cannot go in and say that I know the ultimate reason why God said it should be this way, not in the other way. That type of a reason we can never have. By the way, even when we give Tamei HaMitzvos, we give reasons for the mitzvos, it's not the absolute right. No one can say, well, this is the reason why God said, you can't, it's impossible. Because the ultimate reason is rooted in the knowledge of God, which is beyond any type of human grasp. It's infinite. The only thing is that we can discover certain things about the mitzvahs that are beneficial, and we can say it performs this function, it does this, it does that, but to say, I'm going to give you the reason why God commanded us in the first place, that's an absurdity. V'nemar ki adam yir la'inayim, it says that the man sees to the eyes. He can only, the vision of the eyes is very limited, but Hashem yir la'levav, and God sees to the heart. So the ultimate reason why this is so lies in really the knowledge of God, but this is the system that God gave us. Okay. So the Rambam has given us some more information about the Navi. Now, interestingly enough, over here, the Rambam has said that the Navi, to establish the veracity of his claim, must perform oath and mofet, but did not tell us what exactly the oath and mofet consists of. What does he have to say? Let us then, like this. In Perikas theory, he says like this. Kol Navi sheyamod lanu, any prophet who arises for us, the Omar, and he says, Shashem Shlacho, that God has sent him. Eo Tarach Lasos Os, he does not have to perform a sign. Ki Achad Meoses Moshe Rabbeinu, like one of the signs of Moshe Rabbeinu. O Kaosos Eliyahu, or like the signs of Eliyahu, the Elisha, these great miracles that they perform. Sheyesh Behem Shinui Minhago Shel Olam, which contain a change in the natural order. Does not have to do that. Elo Ha'osha Lo, but the sign that he gives is Sheyomar Dvarim Ha'asidim Lios. He must predict things that are destined to happen in the future. Lios Ba'olam. V'ye'amnu Dvarim, and his words will be verified. In other words, his words will be found to be true. Shenemar, as it says, V'chisam B'lavecha, and if you say in your heart, Eicha Neidas Hadavah, how will I know the word that God has commanded us? Etc., etc. So it says, Lafika, he says, Lafika kishayavo adam haroy lanavua. Therefore, when a person comes who is roi l'nevuah, the gavra is roi for nevuah, the malachas Hashem, v'lo yavu l'hosif v'lo l'groah, and he will not come, he does not come either to add or to detract. Because if a Navi comes and he claims that God sent him to add a mitzvah to the Torah or to detract from the mitzvah of the Torah, he's automatically false. Ela lavar is Hashem the mitzvah of the Torah, but rather that we should, unless it's a Rosh Hashanah, but that's what he means. Ela lavar is Hashem the mitzvah of the Torah, but to serve God according to the commandments of the Torah. Ain omer, in other words, like this, he passes the test in terms of being a gavra. And also the content of his nevuah is not one which would automatically render him false. Because the content also could render him false. If he comes, if he says that God has instructed me to change the Torah. Another refutation of why Jesus could not be a prophet. Anyone who's coming to change the Torah automatically is a false prophet. Or if he says that God told me that you should worship a certain idol, even if it was a Rasha. Now, Ain Omrim Lo, we do not say to him, Karal Lo Masayam, okay, split the sea. Al Hachaye Meis, or bring somebody back to the life who's dead. V'chayote Be'elo, or anything of the like. V'yachach Namin Bach, and afterwards, if you do that, we'll believe you. Ela Omrim Lo, but we say to him, Im Navi Ata, if you are a Navi, and Mar Devarim Hasidim Lios. Just tell us what's going to happen. Predict the future. V'hu Omer, he says, the anu machakim liros, and then we wait to see. Hayavo dvarav im lo yavo, whether his words will come to pass or whether they won't. Biafilu nafal davar katan, and even if the slightest thing is not forthcoming, is missing, biyodua shehu nevi sheker, it is then known that he's a nevi sheker. So every specific detail has to occur. Viimbo dvarav kulam, and if all of his words came to pass, he is then someone who is considered to be a Ne'aman. Now, of course, you might ask, does this mean every time he comes, like a Navi could have different prophecies, right? You know, great Yeshaya and Yirmiyahu and Shmuel, they had many prophecies throughout their life, not just one time. I mean, every time he comes, does he have to establish himself with it? No. Uvokinoso parm harbe. We test him many times. That's at the very beginning. At the beginning, when he comes to us, we test him many times. If all of his words are true, are accurate, hareiz a Navi Emes. This person is now a Navi Emes. Kemoshe nemar b'Shmuel, as it says about Shmuel, Vayeda kol Yisrael midan v'ad ber sheva, ki neman Shmuel a Navi Lashem. That all of Israel knew, from Dan to Be'er Sheva, that Shmuel was a Navi. Now, okay. Then he said, all right, the thing is like this. What I just wanted to point out over here was that it's not that each entity of prophecy requires a separate verification. But you could learn that way. You could say that every time you claim a prophetic vision, because the fact that a person is a prophet, again, some prophets prophesied many times, some only prophesied one time. So you might say that every prophetic entity requires a separate substantiation. The Rambam does not hold that way. The Rambam holds that what? It's the Gavra that requires substantiation. And therefore, when he first comes to us, we subject him to many tests. But once he's established, once Bezin is satisfied, then this person is considered to be a valid Navi. And once he's a valid Navi, then we have to listen to him whenever he comes. I mean, unless you see that he's lost his, like he became a Rasha or something, but if we put him on his Chazakah. So we utilize, with regard to Nevuah, the concept of Chazakah, you see? I just thought that's an interesting point. That is to say that after Shmuel was established, the year, we didn't know, we didn't test him anymore. In fact, you're not allowed to test him. You're not allowed to increase. But you might say like this. You might say that was last year. Last year, when you came to us with a message from God, we tested you and you were verified. How do we know that this one is from God? So the answer is, how do we know that this one is from God? Because this person now has the status of being a trustworthy Navi, and therefore, when he comes to us and tells us that he received another message from God, we're obliged to listen to him.
And even the fact that a person is a Navi is a very good point here. It doesn't mean that he will always be a Navi, he will always be a Tzaddik. He can even become a Rashi, he can even be Chayav Mitzvah. He can become kind of... Yeah, yeah, so... The next point we'll come back to later on. I'm not going to go through it now. There's some more Rambam here. The Rambam tries to... The Rambam says if that's the case, since the whole veracity of a Navi depends upon his ability to predict the future, so then what's the difference between the Navi and the Ma'oninim and the Kosim, the soothsayers and so forth? Because the Rambam held there were people that did have the power to predict the future. The Rambam held that, people do have, there are people who have the ability to see what's going to happen in the future. But he says, yeah, that's the difference. He says the difference is that if it's not Nevuah, but it's just a certain power that a person has to predict the future, then it will not be detailed. It will not be perfect. It's got to be vague, and there'll be a lot of mistakes. And the proof for the act for the genuine Navi is that there's no mistake whatsoever, even the slightest detail. So therefore, it must be that it comes from that. I want to take up the position of Sadia. As we've seen clearly, the Rambam holds that the Navi does not have to perform miracles to establish himself. Right? He does not have to do any shini tava, anything that could change the tava. Now, the Sadia in the Amunas Videos, it's called, in English, it's called the Book of Beliefs and Opinions. Page 145, he takes up the subject of prophecy. And the first, in chapter... In chapter 3, he goes into the whole question of why it's necessary for God to send prophets to mankind in the first place. Alright? We'll skip that for the time being. And then we'll take up his position in chapter 4. He says like this, "And now that we have demonstrated clearly how necessity led God to dispatch messengers to mankind, it is fitting that this discussion be followed up with an explanation of how the authenticity of their mission was established among the rest of men. I say then that human beings realize that it is impossible for them, with such power and ability as they possess, to subdue the elements of nature or to transform the essences of things. They are indeed incapable of doing that, because these are all the work of the Creator. For it is He that subdued the various elements of nature and created them in their composite form, although it is their natural tendency to fly apart. However, God so altered the character of their separate essences that as a result of their combination, no essence of theirs appeared in its pure form anymore, but always as something else than the unadulterated essence. In other words, it's only because of God that God takes the various components that exist in the universe and brings them together and puts them, you know, and establishes them in their current form. I mean that the elements of nature were combined so as to form either a human being or a plant or other such corporeal things. Since men recognize all this, such feats of necessity had to be regarded by them as a sign of the work of the Creator. Hence, any messenger whom the Creator would choose to carry out his mission would, as a matter of course, have to be provided by him with one of these signs." Now, you see, he's talking differently than the Rambam. "This sign might consist of the subjection of elements of nature, such as preventing fire from burning, or keeping water from running, or arresting a heavenly sphere in its course, and the like. It might also take the form of the transformation of substances, such as the conversion of an animal into an inanimate object, or the change of something inanimate into a living thing, or the transformation of water into blood, or blood into water. When therefore one of these signs is presented to the prophet, it becomes the obligation of those men that see it to regard him as holy, and to lend credence to what he tells them, for the All-Wise would not have presented his sign to him unless he had been found trustworthy by him." A totally different approach than the Rambam. Now, you understand? Can somebody summarize the position of Sadia? In other words, what Sadia is saying is that how does a person, in other words, when a person comes to us and he says that he has a message from God, he's got to demonstrate in a way that's irrefutable. Now, he's laying it down as a premise that nature has a fixed order, right? The order of things as we know it is fixed, and it is beyond the power of any human to change that, right? And the only one, the only being who has the ability to transcend nature is God himself, because God has formed it in the first place. So therefore, the only sign, the only demonstration which would be absolutely convincing would be something which no human being can do. And it's only, therefore, when this prophet performs, so to speak, he's really not performing, but he's predicting, he's the one, in other words, it's being done at his word, so to speak, in association with his word, that is the only way that we can truly know that it comes from God. That's very interesting. Now, this is not just his own view, but he brings proof from the Torah. He says, now, although this account of the authentication of a prophetic mission is sanctioned by reason, makes sense, right? But how else? How else would you know beyond any doubt? It is also found in the text of the scriptures. This is known to you from the story of Moses, our teacher, and from the wondrous miracles that were shown to him. Hence, I can dispense with mentioning them here. It has also been explained in the text of the book of Exodus and elsewhere, as well as in the commentary thereon. It is illustrated furthermore by the remark made by Moses to his people, quote, the great trials which thine eyes saw. He says, those of the servants of God then who believe the prophets and accept his words as the truth are the virtuous, as scripture says. And he did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. So you see that he's taking a different track. The idea is saying that the reason for our belief is because of the miracle. And that is what a righteous person would believe. Those, on the other hand, who did not believe him and do not accept his words as true are the erring. This, too, you know from the case of those of whom it was said, because they believe not in God. He just adds, before we go any further, he just adds again, reinforcing the point. At this point, I find it necessary to make an observation for the purpose of safeguarding our belief in the usual fixity of things. What I have reference to is that the Creator, exalted and magnified be He, does not change the substance of anything unless He first calls the attention of the people to the fact that He's about to effect that change. But God's motive in the performance of the miracle is to have men lend credence to His prophet. Wherever such a motive does not exist, there is no reason for changing any substance. For if we were to assume purposeless change to be the rule, then our confidence in the fixity of things would be shaken. None of us could be sure upon returning to his dwelling and family whether the All-Wise had not changed their essences, and whether they were not different from the way in which he had left them. In other words, the point he's trying to make is that the whole premise of his argument is a certain fixity in nature. That God set up the world in a certain way, and things do not change from their ordained path, unless God has a purpose. And the only purpose that God has in bringing about a change in nature is to demonstrate to us the veracity of this individual, to establish prophecy. Okay? So we have Machlokas between the Rambam and Sadia. Now let's take a look. Seemingly enough, Sadia has omitted that whole first component of the Navi, that before we even ask him for any test, so there seems to be two ways in which he disagrees. But first of all, the Rambam says that the first test is on the level of the individual. And the second thing is that we ask him to perform signs, but we do not ask him to perform miracles which go against the laws of nature. He only has to predict future events. The Sadia said that, and the Rambam said that if he just performs miracle by themselves, it's meaningless as far as we're concerned. Sadia, however, said that the whole thing is miracle, right? Changes against the established way of nature. Yes, I'll ask you, what about Paro? Yeah, well, he wasn't a prophet. But God can use the person as an instrument, because he himself didn't even know what it was. Paro did not even know what it was. Yeah, he didn't know what it was. He needed Yosef to interpret it. So that's a different phenomenon. It's a different phenomenon. Case of Moshe by the snare. When God commanded Moshe to go to the to go to Paro and to get, you know, get the Jews together and so forth, and to embark on the mission of freeing the Jews from Mitzrayim. So of course, as you know, Moshe was very reluctant. Moshe debated with God. Chazal say for 7 days. He pleaded with God to send somebody else. And then by Yomer Moshe El Elohim, Moshe said to God, Yanochi Boel Bnei Yisrael. I come to the Jews, Yamarti Lohem, and I say to them, Elokev Osechem Shlachani Alechem, the God of your fathers sent me to you. The Unruly Mashemo, and they'll say to me, what is his name? Ma'omar Alehem, what shall I say to them? Yom Elokim El Moshe, and God said to Moshe, Ekyer Asher Ekyer. Alright, we'll just, I will be, I am that I am. I am that I am. Let's leave it at that. By Yomer, and you said, Kosomar of Bnei Yisrael, thus shall you say to the Bnei Yisrael, Ekyash Lachani Aleichem. I am, has sent you, has sent me unto you. Alright, and then he proceeds. So that was one question. That was one question. Now, the Rambam deals with this, and he says, you know, what kind of a proof would this be? I mean, either they knew. I mean, did the elders know the name, or didn't they know the name? If they knew the name, so then just like they knew it, so Moshe knew it. So that doesn't constitute any proof, right? And if they didn't know the name, so what good is it? How is it going to verify anything? All right. The Rambam says that really, that this name conveys very deep ideas about the nature of, you know, what man can know of the nature of God's essence and God's nature. And that's why this is really a proof to the Chacham, that Moshe would explain to them the concepts behind the name, and this would show that he really had exalted, you know, a very high level of, he had an accurate knowledge of the God of their fathers, the concept of God that they were familiar with. Alright. But you see that that wasn't the only thing that Moshe required. Because then later on, Vayan Moshe Vayomer, after this whole discussion, it says that Moshe responded to God and he said, Vehein lo yaminu li, and they will not believe me. Lo yishmu b'koli, and they will not listen to my voice. Ki yomu, for they will say, Lo nira elech Hashem. They will say that God is a person. You see, that even after God had told them the name that he should tell them, which contains all these ideas, still Moshe said they won't believe that God has appeared to them. Why not? Yeah, because it's, as we said, it's one thing to be on an exalted level and to have all this knowledge of God. But that doesn't prove that God is communicating any specific message. It just means to say that you're on a very high level. You have you're a big chacham. You're a great chacham. You have tremendous knowledge. So where is the truth? You're right. It's true that it's a good point. On the surface, it seems like Moshe is disagreeing with God, but it shouldn't be taken that way. It's rather in the form of a question: By what manner? You know, that they won't believe me. I have to have, in other words, if I don't have any proof, they're not going to believe me. So how do I establish my credentials? That God actually spoke to me. Until now, you gave me the name that I should communicate, the name that they're familiar with, the concept of God that they would be familiar with. Fine. But then, without proof, they're not going to believe. So what? It doesn't prove that God actually spoke to me. Right. So what happened? So, Vayomer Elav Hashem, and God said to him, Mazeh B'yadecha, Vayomer Mateh. Right? Vayomer Shmichei Artos. He told him to cast it on the ground, and he cast it on the ground, and it became a nachash, a snake. He turned into a snake. Vayonas Moshe Ripanov. Moshe ran away from it. Then God said, stretch out your hand and grab onto its tail. He stretched out his hand and he grabbed onto it and it became a staff in his hand. So that was a miracle. That the snake was transformed into a... That the staff, rather, was transformed into a snake and then vice versa. In order that... L'man yaminu. In order that they should believe, Kinyera Elach HaRashem. That God has indeed appeared unto you, the God of your fathers. the God of their fathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Then God said, furthermore, place your hand inside of your cloak, inside by your bosom. And he did that, and he brought it out, and it was smitten with Terah. Smitten with Terah. White as Terah. And then he says, return your hand into your cheik. By Yashav, and he did it again. And then he took his hand out, and it was perfectly healed. By the way, parenthetically, as I'll mention that these two, you mentioned before, these first two, the signs that God gave him, the sign of the snake, and the sign of the Terah, they contain a subtle message as well. And that is, there was an indication that he was wrong for speaking Lashon Hara. And he just said, V'hein lo yaminu. He said, V'hein lo yaminu, they will not believe. So there's another level of dialogue. In other words, God is saying, you're saying they're not believers, they are believers, the sons, the children of believers. In other words, Chazal proved that Moshe should never have expressed himself. In other words, he had a legitimate right to ask for a proof. But the way he expressed it indicated that he held it there on a low level. And that's why the Nachash is a representation of the Lashon Hara, Diba. And the same idea with the Taras. Taras is the punishment that a person gets for Lashon Hara. Okay, but that's not the plain meaning. That's a medrash, a drash. And then, the third sign, V'hoyim lo yaminu lach, and it'll be that if they don't believe you, lo yishmu l'kol ha'os ha'rishon, and they won't listen to the sound of the first sign, then they'll listen to the second sign. And if they don't believe these two signs, and they don't listen to your voice, then you shall take from the waters of the river, the Nile River, and you should spill it on the ground, and the water that you take from the river will become blood on the ground. So in other words, so what do you think of this? This would seem to favor who? This would seem to favor the view of Sadia. And it would be a question on the Rambam, because here you see clearly that the Navi is asking for a proof. This is the issue itself. Proof to the people. One second. And God is giving him osos. And these osos are not predictions of the future. They are all changes in the Teva. That the ones that the sages mentioned, that a staff should turn to a snake. That the person's the hands, the leprosy, and being cured again, and finally the water being changed into blood. So how would the Rambam explain this? This seems to be a proof for the tradition of God. There is glory. Tradition. The Rambam in the Yisrael Torah Plus says, Moshe Rabbeinu lo ha'aminu lo Yisrael b'nei ha'osa sh'asa. The Jews did not believe in him because of the osos, the signs, the miracles that he did. That's not why they believed in him. So in other words, what you're saying is not correct. They did not believe in him even in Mitzrayim, when they were on a lower level of strength. Shammam and Alpia osos, for one who believes because of miracles, yesh believe odofi, he has gotten it. It's not, in other words, what the Rambam is saying is that the belief which is founded upon miracles is not the highest why? She'efshir she'yaseh ha'os b'lat v'kisha. He says it's possible. No. He says it's possible. He says it's possible that the oath can be done with magic.
That's a good point.
One second. If that's the case, one second. If you're going to say that, this itself is complex. He says there's something lacking in these miracles because it's possible. It's possible they could be done with some type of secret method or magic and so forth. Yeah, but that's not so simple to say, because then your point about the 10 plagues, if that's the case, so what was the, in other words, then why was Paro guilty? Why were the Egyptians guilty for not listening to them if they can be duplicated? No. But wasn't it to prove that there was God's will? Didn't he say that God is... Oh, one second. course, they constitute a punishment, but they, assuming that they had listened and not, let's say, after the first plague, they would let the Jews go, so they wouldn't have been a second plague. And so on down the line, right? And, well, the point of that was with a message. God has spoken, because to me, it's God's will to let them, right? If it wasn't because it had nothing to do, why are they guilty and why do they deserve more? More plague? Yeah. If that was it, yeah. But you have to say, and finally what got them the Makas Bechoros is they just had no choice anymore. There was no way they could deny it. Now you saw, by the way, the first, it was only in the first few, all of the second. You have a big question over here. They were able to duplicate. Which one did they? They were able to duplicate a few of them. Yeah. They could duplicate. Then it's an Etzpelokim. Etzpelokim, this is the hand of the finger of God. Which meant they couldn't be duplicated. Yeah, but now you have one thing. There's a few questions over there. Let's just set up the question because I don't want you to do a little thinking over there. Hold on a second. Because the question will be, now we get into this whole issue of the plague and the signs. Because they said the signs of Nachash, they were ostensibly able to duplicate. Well, if you can duplicate it, so what's the sign? What's the proof? It's got to be something which man cannot duplicate. Right? Moreover, after the third one, where it's okay. But yeah, all right. But okay. All right. You're right. Good. But after the third one, then they couldn't duplicate it. So first of all, what's going on here? The first three should not have been subject to duplication in the first place. The ones that are after that, why make, what kind of a sign is it if it can be duplicated? That's a good question. But this was, one second. This was the Torah. This wasn't to establish. Hold on a second. Maybe you're right, Lord. Maybe it's a kasha. I don't know. I'm just stating you've got to consider these issues. I mean, like, the thing is like this. First of all, there's a few questions going on. One question, these questions sort of overlap. One question is the kasha of the Rambam. We don't use miracles to establish anything. But you see that God gave miracles to Moshe. The Rambam said no. Because Moshe made a lohamim for Yisrael. No, also Shalva. They did not believe him because of the oath. Okay. But when that's going to be a problem. But God gave him those signs to go to the Jews. We were given to the Jews. All right? Then when they went to Paro, they did use signs. Now, it's those of the 10 plagues. Now, it's strange, because some of them were able to be duplicated. So why give anything that can be duplicated? Moreover, the ones that couldn't be duplicated are assumed to be valid. They're certainly assumed to be valid. But the Rambam says that they didn't believe in Moshe because of the Yosha. So even though Moshe had the level, he had the ability, he had the perfection, and he performed the Yosha, we didn't believe that wasn't the thing that caused them to believe in him. Because here he's saying it's weak. It's subject to doubt. About, after Kriyas Yom Tov, which Sadia says, close the Pasuk, by you mean about Hashem of Moshe Abdo. And they believed in God and in Moshe's servant. Well, the Torah says they believed it. That was by Kriyas Yom Tov. And that was also. So the question is like this. What we're going to have to try and do, let's see if we can get some water over here, is to resolve the machlokas in the Rambam and Sadia, and to answer these questions on the Rambam. The Rambam, let me just go a little bit further. The Rambam says, all the miracles that Moshe did in the desert, he only did them because of necessity. Not to prove anything. Not to prove a point. Lo lahabi raya l'hanavua. Not to bring the raya for the Nevuah. Hayatzarach lashkia es hamitriyam. He had to destroy the Egyptians. Karas hayam. This was the Hitzliwam. So therefore he split the sea and they drowned. It wasn't done to prove that he's a prophet. They needed food. Brought down the manna. They became thirsty. He split the stone and brought forth water. The congregation of Korach denied him, so they were swallowed in the earth to prove that they were false. and so too all the other Oso. So,
it is, if miracles, no matter how profound they are, no matter how profound they are not ultimate indicators of the truth, then what thing how do we know? What is the ultimate? What is the ultimate foundation that we do believe the prophecy of Moshe? Alright, that's the question. Also, if so, why did God give Moshe these signs? Right? God gave them signs. To changing a staff into a snake and so forth, right? And also, what does it mean when it says in the Torah that after the creation of the Yamin of Hashem with Moshe Abed, they did believe. It seems that they did believe as a result of it. How does the Rambam explain all these things? Alright, we'll leave this for next time.
We said last week that the Rambam takes up the different opinions out of that prophecy, and we took up the first two.
The first one was that there are no particular requirements
For the prophet, that basically anybody could be a prophet. So, except they said someone who's morally wicked. But other than that, an ignoramus could be a prophet. So he said that view was based on the concept of prophecy, which was basically that prophecy is nothing, it's a simple type of a thing, in which the prophet is basically passive. And the recipient of the message which comes from God. It's like flashing onto a screen. So any person can serve as a screen. It doesn't require any sophisticated understanding. Except they wouldn't go so far as to say that a wicked person could be endowed with prophecy because God wouldn't honor such a person. It's a great honor to receive a message from God, and God does not associate himself with a wicked person. That's not the view of the Torah. That's the Rambam says that's the view of the majority of people, but it's a false view.
Because of ignorance.
Right. Then we went to the other view, which is the view of the philosophers, who hold that prophecy stems from the natural faculty in man. And that I tried to explain that point, that it exists in the framework of the natural order. That is to say that man has a potential for prophecy. Provided that the faculty is in a proper form, and provided that he brings it to its perfection, then it will occur naturally. It's like anything else that a human being is capable of doing. Of course, it exists only very rarely within the minority of the species, but that doesn't matter. But many things exist within a minority of the species. But when it occurs, it has to be regarded as a natural phenomenon, not as a miraculous phenomenon. Okay. We went further and we explained how this could be so. It seems to be absurd to even state such a thing. So we said that this view holds that what is prophecy? Prophecy is a insight into the future events, into the future events that which is beyond the scope of the normal perception. Now, since that which is going to be is determined by certain causes, right? These causes are of an intellectual nature. It's just that they're hidden from our view. Nothing happens by accident. What we call accident is just a descriptive term because we don't know what the causality is. And nothing that happens by chance, a leaf falls off a tree. I mean, we don't know when it's going to happen, but if we knew all the factors that were in operation, we'd be able to predict. So the prophet has access to the chain of causality. And since he has access to the chain of causality, he can predict future events. That's the view. Now, that's the diametrically opposed. Obviously, according to this, an ignoramus or an ordinary person could not be a prophet. So the question is, what is the view of Judaism? So we took up, I asked for opinions, and we had a few ideas. We had one idea was that in Judaism it's a combination. Well, the two, all right? Combination of the idea. That was Jackie's idea, that it's somehow a combination. That prophecy is basically an emanation, stems from God, but that it can only relate to an individual who's out of perspective. Okay? That was one view. That's a valid view, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were philosophers who maintained that view. Just so happens it's not the view of the Rambam. So let's read the view of the Rambam. The third view is that which is taught in Scripture, and which forms one of the principles of our religion. So therefore belief in this, obviously, is one of the foundations. One has to believe in the veracity of prophecy. It coincides with the opinion of the philosophers in all points except one. Now listen to the formulation, and I won't go into the asking you afterwards what you think is interesting or complex or difficult about it. For we believe that even if one has the capacity for prophecy and has duly prepared himself, it may yet happen that he does not actually prophesy. It is, in that case, the will of God that withholds from him the use of the faculty. According to my opinion, this fact is as exceptional as any other miracle, and acts in the same way. For the laws of nature demand that everyone should be a prophet who has a proper physical constitution and has been duly prepared as regards education and training. If such a person is not a prophet, he is in the same position as a person who, like Yerubam, is deprived of the use of his hands or of his eyes, as was the case with the army of Syria in the history of Elisha. As for the principle which I laid down, that preparation and perfection of moral and rational faculties are the sine qua non, our sages say exactly the same. Quote, the spirit of prophecy only rests upon persons who are wise, strong, and wealthy. We have explained these words in our commentary on the Mishnah and in our large work. That's the Mishnah code. We stated there that the sons of the prophets were constantly engaged in preparation, that those who have prepared themselves may still be prevented from being prophets may be inferred from the history of Baruch, the son of Neriah, for he followed Jeremiah, who prepared and instructed him. And yet he hoped in vain for prophecy, that he says, quote, I am weary with my sighing, and rest have I not found. He was then told through Jeremiah, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt say to him, thou seekest for thee great things, do not seek. Interesting idea. Why did God inform him of that? You follow the gist of the discussion, right? Well, God communicated to Yirmiyahu to tell his Talmud, Baruch ben Neriah, not to try. Give it up. It's not for you. That speaketh for things too great. It's an interesting idea that the point is, though, that one of the principles of Judaism is that it's an interesting thing. We always say that a person should strive to reach its fullest potential. I mean, especially in the area of importance, like knowledge. Right? A person shouldn't be content with his knowledge. Because whatever he knows is just a fraction, and he should always seek for more, because this is the good. But, on the other hand, it's also important to recognize one's limitations, and not to enter into areas that are beyond your scope. See, people are for two possible reasons. Sometimes people are because of too much cautiousness, timidity. They're afraid to either that, I mean, it could be, I don't know, it could be fear, it could be laziness, or complacency, whatever the cause is, but they don't enter into areas where they should. And I'm very often in communities, very often to find some people, they get good in a certain area, you know, like a person has his thing, he's good in this subject, he's good in Gemara, he likes Chumash, he likes Navi, he likes Halacha, I like this, which is all right. There's nothing wrong with having a specialty. There's nothing wrong with having a specialty, but at the same time, it should not prevent you from going off into other areas and expanding your views and your horizon, because
In that case, the person has a defense. He doesn't want to engage in the exploration. Why? Because there's a certain amount of pain. He likes the quick enjoyment, the easy. It's become easy. Let's say you have to work at the business. You know, he's become good at it, and he likes it, and he gets satisfaction. So he doesn't want to experience a sense of frustration in a new area. Right? So he's depriving himself. And he's protecting himself. He's protecting his feelings. And that could be it could be a defect in learning. It could be a defect, as you know, obviously in all areas of endeavor, not just in knowledge, but I'm sure it affects people professionally, etc. On the other hand, it's very important to know one's limitations. There are other people that suffer from the other problem, and that is they like to go into areas that they're not necessarily prepared for. That probably would be, I'm not going into all the causes, but it could be ego. A lot of it probably is ego. They have a certain ego idea. They can't stand the fact that they're not on a level to go into advanced physics and metaphysics or philosophy and so forth. So Judaism, there's no easy way. Judaism recognizes that knowledge is essential for one's perfection, but that if a person enters into certain areas, it could destroy it as well. So his search for knowledge has to be tempered by both factors. In other words, he can't be complacent and lazy, and therefore he has to exert himself to the utmost. At the same time, he has to be capable of knowing what his limitations are. And that's what God communicated to Baruch Samiria. This is too wondrous for you. Beyond you, you're not going to get it. Don't do it. Don't waste your time and your energy. Of course, it could be more than just a waste of time and energy. It could be dangerous. As you know, the famous story that four entered the Pardes. The Pardes is a reference to metaphysics, and only one emerged unscathed. Right? One went crazy, one, was damaged, etc. It's to enter into areas, and that, by the way, that is really ideas which we got. By the way, the one who really illustrates this is Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu asked God, Hareini Noach Kodecha, please show me your glory. And the Rambam interprets that to mean that he wanted to grasp the essence of God's nature. And God's answer was, Kilo Yirani Adam Bachai, that one cannot see me, that is, one cannot see me means to actually perceive. Perceive me intellectually while one is alive. However, Chazal says that when I wanted to, you didn't want. And when was that? By the burning bush. But he says, Vayachter Moshe Panav, that Moshe turned away his face. Kiyore Lehavit Elohim, because he's afraid to look at God. Now what does it mean he's afraid to look at God? The burning bush wasn't God. One can't say such a thing. The burning bush was a phenomenon created by God, right, to draw Moshe's attention. It was a manifestation. So Kiyare, his fear of looking at God, the Rambam says, he was afraid to intellectually try and perceive certain ideas about God. He drew back. That's what it means, he covered his face. So God says, when I wanted to reveal myself, you turned away. When I wanted to, you didn't want. Now, did you want? I don't want. And that was the answer to the Yerani Adam Bachai. Now, Moshe, therefore, was involved in that very issue. Was involved in that issue, deciding how far he can go. How far he can go. And he decided that he had to cover his face, that he had to stop at a certain point. To try and go intellectually beyond that point, he held, would have been dangerous. The guides later on say he could have gone further. He could have gone further. But that's, you know, one could be wrong about a thing like that. You know, one is not always accurate in these things. I mean, you have to be, like anything else, you have to decide. But these are the two poles within which a person has to maneuver. Interesting point. We're referring now to the words of the Rambam and the Maravukum. It may perhaps be assumed that prophecy is here described as a thing, quote, too great for Baruch. So also the fact that, quote, her prophets did not find visions from the Lord may be considered as the result of the exile of her prophets, as will be explained. There are, however, numerous passages in Scripture, as well as in the writings of our sages, which support the principle that it depends chiefly on the will of God.
who is the prophecy and at what time, and then he only selects the best and the wisest. What does he mean by that? There are, however, numerous passages in Scripture as well as in the writings of our sages which support the principle that it depends chiefly on the will of God. Who is the prophecy and at what time? That's not the Rambam position, that it depends chiefly on the will of God. Because the role that God plays over there is of a different kind. And that would seem to be like your view. And that he only selects the best and the wisest. That's the view that Jackie was saying. That there are passages in Scripture which support the view that it depends chiefly on the will of God. However, God only selects the best and the wisest. So that is that there's a requirement for the godless. But the nature of the phenomenon is that that's not the view of the Rambam that he's been explaining. Now he says something very interesting over here. He holds that fools and ignorant people are unfit for this distinction. It is as impossible for any one of these to prophesy as it is for an ass or a frog. I don't know that. He just means to give an illustration. Just like Noah would imagine that a frog could prophesy. So he says, because that's impossible. But people don't imagine that. It's interesting. Why is it that way? Why is it that people don't imagine? The Rambam is saying that it's just as impossible. He's telling it to us for a reason. Obviously, because people don't look at it that way. People would say, no, a frog, of course, can't. But an ordinary human being who's not a great thinker, and he can. Well, why is it that people would look at it for two cases different? But the Rambam is saying it's absolutely no difference. Let's try and resolve that. Emotionally, it may seem that an ordinary person is possible for him to prophesy because he's a person, he's a human being, even though he's not right. But the Rambam is saying if you look at the matter intellectually, it's an either or kind of thing. It's impossible. Because he lacks the faculty. And conceptually, he's no different than the frog in this respect. It doesn't matter. So people make a distinction because he has a human form. So they view him, interesting, this is what I think. Since he has human form, they view him as being closer to the real prophet than they do the donkey. Okay? But the Rambam saying is that he's just as far away. Yeah. It makes no difference. It's not, you know what I mean? It makes no difference. Unless you say that he has the potential. Yeah, he is different in respect of the potential, but lacking that change, he's no different whatsoever. Well, prophecy is impossible without study and training. When these have created the possibility, then it depends on the will of God whether the possibility is to be turned into reality. Yeah, you have to study the Torah, especially the Rambam, any time his words are carefully chosen, but in the Torah, you got to be very careful. What is he saying over here? He's not saying it depends chiefly on the will of God in the sense that, you know, we just said before. We must not be misled by the words of Yirmiyahu. Before I formed thee in the womb, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth from the womb, I sanctified thee. What does he mean? He means don't be misled. Where it says, before I formed thee in the womb, I knew thee. He says this to Yirmiyahu, which implies that I designated you from when you were in the womb. This is just not what it means. But this is the case with all prophets. It means to say there must be a physical preparation from the beginning of their existence, as will be explained. Let's just finish up the paragraph, anyway, then we'll summarize. As to the words, quote, for I am young, it is well known that the pious Joseph, when he was 30 years old, is called by the Hebrew young, nar. Also Yahushua, when he was nearly 60 years old, was called nar, young. For the statement, quote, and his minister Yahushua, the son of Nun, was young, occurs in the account of a golden calf. Moses was then 81 years old. He lived 120 years. Joshua, who survived him 14 years, lived 110 years, and must consequently have been at least 57 years old at the time when the golden calf was made, and yet he is called Nar, young. Nor must we be misled by prophecies like the following. Quote, I will pour out my spirit over all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy. That's a reference to Yemos HaMashiach. I will pour out my spirit So that implies that what? That what is prophecy? God pours forth his spirit over all flesh. That goes counter to the Rambam's view, right? He says, no, don't be misled by that. Since it is distinctly stated what is meant by prophecy in this place, namely, the old man will dream dreams, the young man shall see visions. But we call also prophets all those who reveal something unknown by surmises or conjectures or correct inferences. He means to say that people will be at a very high intellectual level. In other words, just like in today, in the vernacular, they refer to a visionary as a prophet. Somebody, not a true prophet, right? They'll say that this leader was prophetic. He saw, you know what I mean? Yeah, he was prophetic. He was a prophet. He knew, and therefore he built this thing, whatever it is. It doesn't mean true prophecy. It meant that he had a good insight. Azal was the other. Thus, prophets of Baal and of Asherah are mentioned in Scripture. And God says, if there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams. As to the revelation on Mount Sinai, all saw the great fire and heard the fearful thunderings that caused such an extraordinary terror. But only those of them who were... This is a very interesting point. What was the status of the Jews at Sinai? But only those of them who were duly qualified were prophetically inspired, each one according to his capacity. Therefore, it is said, come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Avihu. Moses rose to the highest degree of prophecy, according to the word, and Moses alone shall come near the Lord. Aaron was below him, Nadab and Avihu below Aaron, and the 70 elders below Nadab and Avihu, and the rest below the latter, each one according to his degree of perfection. Similarly, our sages wrote, Moses had his own place, and Aaron his own. Since we have touched upon the revelation on Mount Sinai, we will point out in a separate chapter what may be inferred as regards the nature of that event, both from the scriptural text, in accordance with reasonable interpretation, and from the words of our sages. And the next chapter goes into the whole thing of Sinai, which is another thing, is that the Rambam deliberately wrote the sequence of the paragraphs. If you follow the Mora, you'll find you don't necessarily, one paragraph doesn't seem to follow from the previous one. It's very hard to, aside from understanding what I think he's saying, it's very hard to understand how he arranged. All this is done deliberately, for that same reason. That I mentioned before, in writing the Mora, the Rambam was faced with the same problem, that he, certain things may not be revealed to the masses, because it's beyond their capacity. He deliberately wrote it and organized it in a way that the average person would not be able to really figure it out and wouldn't harm them. This was a major task of the Rambam. He writes in the introduction, he has to justify, because he was going into metaphysics here. And metaphysics is a subject which cannot be taught publicly. So how did he have a right to do this? So he justifies himself that he was transmitting certain secrets of Judaism, which were in danger of being lost. And he did so, but he took tremendous pains to do so in a way that would not violate the injunction, and that it would come out the perfect work, that those who were prepared and they had the prerequisites would gain from it, his objective would be fulfilled, and those who did not have the prerequisites, he said, if they just read it on a simple level, they'll get something out of the book, and they won't be harmed by it. So very often, I mean, it's just an aside, it's a challenge to, we're just trying to figure out what one paragraph is doing in that context. But this is the end of the paragraph. So, how could you summarize the view of the Rambam now? Who can summarize the view? Obviously, those who came in the middle will be able to do so, but those who read the whole talk. The essence is, as you said, we agree with the philosophers in their whole point, except for one. But this one is problematic. Because he says that we believe that even if one has the capacity to prophesy and has duly prepared himself, it may yet happen that he does not actually prophesy. The question arises, how could it? Well, the Rambam is definitely saying that prophecy is a natural phenomenon. Well, if that's the case, if he has the capacity and he's duly prepared himself, how can it happen that he doesn't prophesy? Because God is a being. It is in that case the will of God that withholds from him the use of the faculty. According to my opinion, this fact is as exceptional as any other miracle. So it's a miracle.
The miracle that he's not prophesying.
That he's not
prophesying. But he's feeling like disagreeing with the other opinion, because he's saying that he can't
Because it would be lacking or not the prophecy?
Because it would be lacking,
and it would not be able to stop. Is that
what
the Rambam is saying? Not lacking. I'm not sure. Let me just state it, what I mean. He gives the example himself. He says that this would be the time, the Rambam says like this. This is the diametric opposite of the first view holds that a person's prophecy is a miracle. Right? The Rambam's view is that if a person who is geared and prepared doesn't, that's a miracle. The fact that he hasn't prophesied is a miracle. But he says the example he gives is the keynote of the case of Yeruvim that he mentions. When the prophet came to warn Yeruvim, and Yeruvim stretched out his hand against him, and his hand became paralyzed, and he couldn't bring it back. That's the case that he mentioned. Now, his inability to bring it back is miraculous, because in the laws of nature, if there's a cup here and you want the cup, right? Now, everything is geared so that if your mind gives your arm the signal, it has to happen. It must, with the laws of nature. If all this, assuming there's no neurological problem, etc., if you reach forward to get it and it won't go, that's a miracle. That means that God is intervening and he's preventing the use of the faculty. So therefore the Rambam is there. If we're going to say now that just like I have a faculty to pick something up, so too I have a faculty to prophecy. When that faculty is in its proper state, I must prophecy. It's a natural thing. You must do it. Just like anything else, if I'm thinking. If I have the information in my mind to solve the problem, figure out the answer, and there's nothing stopping me, I have the time, no one interrupting me, I must come up with a solution. It's the law of nature. Unless something extraneous will prevent me. So that's God. That's his position. We agree with the philosophers then. That's the view of the philosophers. Except we disagree and we say that even if everything is dead, God may intervene. Okay? What is difficult about the Roman position? Well, there is a problem, a logical problem, with maintaining this position. There is a problem. I don't mean questions, you could ask many questions. I'm sure the question that's on your mind right now is what determines whether God will enable them. Right? Why should it be this way? Correct? Why would God stop from you? I'm not asking, I don't know. That's not the question that I'm looking for. The position. If you want to be analytic, this position itself is problematic. And I would like to see whether you can spot the problem, as I always do. Now, not that God causes an imperfection in the person. That's a good point. And what him is saying is the way God operates is by bringing him down a notch so that he's no longer in the level of the prophecy. Is that what you mean?
We're not allowing him to attain the last step.
I don't think so. You could make it. Right, but it's not. I don't think so. Because the Rambam says it's miraculous. When God does this, it is the same as when God prevents your Rambam from taking his hand back, which means that he had the full capacity to do so. I would also think that would be complicated because God will not act to cause a person to go to a lower level. You follow? In other words, like this. Why would God, right? In other words, since prophecy reflects that the individual is on the highest state of perfection.
Then why wouldn't
he? Okay, that's a good point. That is a good point. Yes. Now, for some reason, God may not want you to have the prophetic experience. That might not necessarily be in God's will. Why the Rambam hasn't said? But I would imagine that God simply prevents you from using the faculty. But why would God demote you, so to speak, to a lower level in which you're not, you know what I mean? That I don't think would be or would be necessary.
It would seem that you really, that person did not necessarily attain a state.
It would be to say, the person has stated, no, but that's not what he's saying. He has achieved the requisite degree of perfection. It would be to say, in intellectual matters, if a person reached a certain level of knowledge and understanding and wisdom, and God just didn't want him to go into a certain area for whatever reason, why would God demote him and make him intellectually inferior? God could simply prevent them by other means from attaining the things. That's how I understand it. Although, I mean, your view is not entirely, buckled. But I don't think of it as a Rambam does compare to the case of bringing his arm back. I mean, God did not demote the Rambam physically to make him physically. After that incident, he was able to use his arm. It was just a momentary thing. He'll divert, doctrinal diversion.
No.
I don't know. No, we don't know how God prevents it. God can prevent the person in many ways. I really don't know. I just don't know. He prevents him from using the faculty. The faculty is there, it's capable. He can prevent it from using it. Because obviously when a person is going to use it, he has to be in the best possible state. So God may prevent him from physically, whatever it means. Yes, right? God could prevent him from getting into that state where he would properly. You see? I don't know. I don't know. We're really, here's where we're going beyond now. Mm-hmm. Information. It's not necessary, I don't think. That's not the crucial point. We should be directing ourselves at the problem. There's something very problematic. In other words, what I'm saying is that the Rambam is not really saying anything yet. He's not giving us an answer. There's a problem with his answer. The key sentence, for we believe that even if one has the capacity of prophecy and has duly prepared himself, it may yet happen that he does not actually prophesy. In that case, the will of God, it is the will of God that withholds from him the use of the faculty. God can temporarily prevent you from using your faculty. And according to my opinion, this fact is as exceptional as any other miracle. And acts in the same way. So, if we know how other miracles work, we'll know this one. Everybody's mind is going to be why? Why should it be?
How can it be? It's
very possible.
It's the whole nature that if it happens that way, there must be a reason that God
is being
supposed to
go. Right, there must be a reason. But the fact that it's the law of nature, well, the master of nature, the one who is above nature, can
change it.
Right. Can do miracles. Do you believe in miracles? If you believe in miracles, the philosophers didn't hold miracles, apparently. The philosophers held, they believed in God, and they believed that prophecy is a natural faculty, but apparently, they didn't see this idea about a miracle. If it's natural, it's going to happen. Whatever is natural will happen. You're expressing the view of the philosopher. Yeah, what do you mean? If it's natural, it's going to happen. Why should it be different than anything else that's natural? The philosophy did not see a distinction.
There has to be a reason.
I'm not asking why. I do care very much, but that's not my question is. I'm saying that the actual position of the Rambam is difficult. Now, I mean, not everyone who has the that God can withhold it. Is that a halachic prophecy? Are you telling us that you're not telling us anything about prophecy? Isn't the same thing true? I'll tell you what, in other words, like this.
Is that part of the actual...
It's not part of the idea of prophecy. God can't, it's part of anything. Yeah, so since we know, since we accept the fact, in other words, if I'm asking you, what is your concept of prophecy? Right? So you're going to tell me your concept of prophecy. Your concept of prophecy is, that prophecy is either it's a miraculous phenomenon, that could be your current concept, or it's a non-miraculous phenomenon. What's the combination thereof, as you wanted to say? Fine. But if you tell me what the Rambam can say about prophecy, can you say about anything? What then is tennis? Is tennis a natural thing or a miraculous thing? It's a natural thing. But can't go into the field as a tennis player? Yes! That's not specific about the tennis. I'm asking you to tell me about prophecy. I want to know if it's natural or not. The answer is it's natural. The fact of the matter is that God can prevent anything that's natural from happening. That's what he's told me. But that's true. In other words, that's true not because of something inherent in prophecy. That's true because God can intervene with anything. So what's the wrong? The other one telling that over here in prophecy, then you can say they're walking. So I'm asking, what is walking? Is walking natural or miraculous? Well, the Rambam will say that it's natural. Yeah, but God can stop the person from walking. So therefore, I have views. Now I ask you this. If we were to ask the question, the view of the philosophers on walking and our view on walking. So the view of the philosophers is that walking is a natural thing, right? And anyone who develops the ability will walk. Good. Then you'll ask the Rambam, what's the Torah's view? He'll say the Torah's view of walking agrees with the philosophers in every respect except one. We hold that a person can be able to walk, but God by something wouldn't say that. Well, I mean, that's crazy when they say that the Torah is a different view of walking. Right? The fact that God can prevent it for certain reasons is true. So we say that God prevented your Rambam from using his hands.
Does this change our view of using the hand? Now we say the view of the hand, our view of using the hand is different than the view of the philosophers. That doesn't make any sense. So what is the Rabbi saying over here? So really, you should say that our view is the view of the philosophers. I, God wants to believe, of course, so I can't believe anything.
Anyway, I think that Hinda Bursi hit it right on the head. Let me say the position. There is existence then, just to clarify matters, I'll ask you this question. How would you characterize the difference between God intervening in prophecy and God intervening in a person walking? God can, a person can have the ability to walk and God can stop him miraculously, right? Yet, if I were to ask the Rambam his position on walking, he would say that we agree, walking is a natural thing. So how would you conceptualize the difference between God intervening in a person walking and God intervening in a prophecy? But I think what you mean is that the act of walking is totally the other, totally given over to man. To lose the duty effect. And not every act, God does not exercise a check on every act of walking. It's not built into the nature of the thing. However, in a given case, for whatever reason, God may prevent the person from using the practical. But when God does so, it is extraordinary. However, in prophecy, it's built into the phenomenon that God exercises the constant watch of prophecy. And God exercises a veto power. That is to say that, let's use an analogy as though there is a gateway into, there's a gateway, and you have to get through all the obstacles, right? And when you've gone through all the obstacles, and all you have to do is walk through into the other room, right? Which you have the natural capacity to do so. But God has a watching at that gate to see who you are, deciding whether to let you go through. So that if you are stopped from going through, right, that is a, right, because in the laws of nature you should be able to go through. You've gone through all the obstacles and you can walk through to the other side. But God exercises a veto power. And that is built in to the phenomenon of prophecy. It's built into the phenomenon.
So why can't you just say that?
So why is it that, why is it not, why do, what do we mean now? We mean there is, just let me finish the explanation. So but it's natural. When the person walks through and sees, right, when the phenomenon occurs, it is of a natural thing that occurs. You see? However, in order for this natural thing to occur, right, the person has to pass through the checkpoint. In other words, God exercises a veto. God exercises a veto over it. God has a constant watch. This natural faculty is tied in with God's permission, requires God's permission, so to speak, to be used. God may not allow it to be used. God may or may not. It's in the nature of the thing itself. But when it is used, it's not a miracle. It just means that God is not preventable. You understand the difference? Well, you could say that as opposed to saying that God actually changes the person, picks you up. That's right. The other thing would be that man can't get over that canyon by himself. That God has to pick you up and take you over. Okay? You don't understand what miracle means then.
God
is not a miracle. But the fact that I'm permitted to experience this natural phenomenon, right? But the fact that I'm permitted to do so is due to God's permission. I need God's permission. But when God gives me the permission, he doesn't do anything to enable me. He's not enabling me. He's just not closing the door in my face. That's all. But that's different than the philosophers. The philosophers hold that it's like nothing else, like anything else. The philosophers hold there's absolutely no difference between prophesying and walking. Anyone who can walk, anyone who can prophesy, can prophesy. Absolutely no difference. We hold that in one respect it's the same. It's not the exercise of the faculty is natural.
But what about the theory that
the Rambam holds this up, so it's not been stopped. He's been tested. God is allowed to do it. $54 question. Which I don't know that I can answer, but maybe some of you have some inspiration here.
What is the reason for this? If the question would naturally ask itself, if it's a natural faculty and God implanted it in man, then why would it be this way? Why is it that a person, now you can tell, of course, God doesn't want a bad person to prophesy and so on and so forth, etc. But it seems to be protected that a bad person, it seems to be that God worked it out in a way that the danger wouldn't manifest itself because, yeah, anyone that had a defect wouldn't prophesy and so forth. So would have been disqualified extremely. I mean, the way the Rambam describes in the Mishnah Torah, the level that a person has to be on, it's not just a good person that's affected, but such a high that one wonders how we have so many prophets.
And rich, that was the rich.
Well, the Rambam over there says, by the way, the Rambam is by life, it's a good point. Yeah, why would a person, why would wealth be the factor? Why would wealth be the factor? So the, The Rambam in a different place, the Rambam in a different place says that by wealthy, they don't mean materialistically wealthy, but Sameh Pachelka. Ezeh Oshia Sameh Pachelka. That means he was wealthy. One of the ways, content with what he has. Which is very difficult.
You have to point that out. Wouldn't that be part of protection?
That's the question. That's the question. But then the answer would be that that you would be pointing out specifics of perfection, which specific aspect of perfection, that's an essential component. That capacity to be content with one's material possession would be a major element of perfection. According to that view, Jackie asked correctly, I mean, perfection. Yeah, true, it's perfection, but we have to know the particulars of perfection. And we learn from this that parenthetically, we learn from this that Tameh Pachelko is an extremely high level of perfection. It doesn't seem to be that way, because it's the kind of thing that, you know, people don't seem to, you know, regard as being that, you know, that advanced, that hard. You know, people seem to think, well, I'm content, I'm satisfied, and so forth. Apparently, it's not so simple. The true idea of Tameh Pachelko is not such a simple thing. It means that's the idea that was expressed by Yaakov, as opposed to Esau. You remember in the Chumash when they had that what? Yes. Once they have a lot. When Yaakov wanted to give those gifts to Esau to pacify him, so Esau didn't want to accept it. They were going up and back, you know. He refused it. He didn't want it first. He wasn't accepting it, but he first didn't want to. So he says, Aki, Yesh li rav, Yivachash Allah. Right? Yesh li rav, I have a lot. Yivachash Allah, you keep what you have. So it was very nice, it was very magnanimous, he was willing to forgive him. And Yaakov wanted to make sure that he got the gift. So he says, please, he keeps pleading with him to accept it. Kichanani Elokim, Bechiyesh li chol. Because God has favored me, and I have everything. So Rashi points out that Esau used a expression of gaiva. Yesh li rav, I have a lot. And Yaakov used the proper expression, I have everything. Now on the surface doesn't seem to make sense. You know, because first of all, the two terms don't seem to be that different. When, I have a lot. I have a lot sounds good. I have a lot. And he said, I have everything. If anything, if he was ever a guy, then great, I have everything. But nevertheless, Rashi makes a very major point. This really indicates the difference between the two. One's a Rasha, and one is a Tariq. So what's the answer here?
A lot.
It implies one other thing. The term I have a lot, it also means how a person... Right, how a person relates to the physical, mm-hmm. to the material. A lot means that it's not necessity, but it's relative. Because what is a lot? A lot means relative to what the other person has. So that's an expression of the gaiva. He feels good, he feels secure because he has a lot. But he's involved in the fantasy. He can't say he has everything, because it all depends upon the relative. Now, a person that's involved in wealth
as a fantasy to maintain a certain position, that's alter ego, that's gaiva. So he can never say that he has everything. It's impossible because there's always something more out there. It's a means to bolstering his ego, and it's all relative to what others have, so how can you say he has everything? It's relative. Now, to be able to say that I have everything is to try to go on. Because he's living in the world of reality, and in reality, he's involved in the true good. So then when he turns to the physical, he only looks at the physical as a means to an end. So therefore, it's a finite thing. See, rav means infinite. There's no end to it. So since there's no end to it, how can I say I have everything? Then what? But I could say I have a lot. Because I compare myself to others that have less than me. That's the ego. But the person who's involved, because that's because he is not involved in the true good. So what is the good for him? The good is some fantasy. But if he's involved in the good, so then he looks at the physical as a necessity, as a means to an end. So he could say, this is what I need. He knows his needs. And they're finite. My needs are finite. You make a list of what his needs are. And then, what do you mean, you have enough? If you say this idea to the average person, I think you're crazy. You have enough. That's why the business, you know, the biggest building is. They don't stop. Why don't they stop? They certainly have enough, but they don't have enough. Because how can you say you have enough? There's always more. There's always more out there. So therefore, what you consider, what you need is not determined by what your true requirements are, but by what is out there. So it's endless. It's endless. I could have this, I could have that, I could have the other thing. That also fits in very well at that very same story over there, the Chazal mentioned, by Yivata Yaakov Avada, right after that point, right after the meeting with Esau, it says by Yivata, I think it was right before that, if I'm not mistaken, right before that. By Yivata Yaakov Avada, he was left alone when he had them cross the camp. That was before the meeting with Esau. When he had them cross over the at night, and he had the encounter with the Malach. So how did he remain alone? So it says that he returned from Pachim Kitaran. Because he was moving for the small stuff, right, the small stuff. But Pachim Kitaran, the small one. And it says that we see from this another Chazal, which implies the opposite. That the Tzadikim, their mammon, their money is precious to them like their lives. Because that's why they find the danger when he returns to Pachim Kitaran. When you have to get out of there, you have to move, so you don't run back into the house to talk to the town. For the small stuff, I mean, something.
Yes, that makes your touch. Yes, that's quite the contrary. That's quite the contrary, right? Quite the contrary. One would say that just the opposite. You see, you would think a person, if you read in the paper about a person that there was in a house on fire and they ran in and they got killed, right? Why? Because of some small thing, some petty thing, even for an important thing to say they're crazy. But for a petty thing? Yet Yaakov is praised. Alright, he wasn't running into a fire, but nevertheless, he exerted himself and it wasn't a dangerous situation for popping the time for the little thing.
Essential.
So what's the
basically,
the
essential.
It's just
fine,
so if the answer
is like this. He would have had to work to get him to replace them, and it would have been.
Yeah, but what about, but they're small, but they're trivial. But they're trivial.
No, but they're necessary.
That's the point. The point is that there is no, that a tzaddik, you see, that a tzaddik doesn't have problems to come. That's what it means. It means what we would say, it means this very interesting idea. Each person, if he looks at his own possessions, he will see that he has a lot of stuff he doesn't really need. Right? Junk. Mm-hmm. He has junk, he has too much, and he has to get rid of it. He has things he doesn't need. Now, what does that represent? Okay, I mean, practically speaking, I don't want to give anybody a guilt trip, because, we all have this failing, but that means that you invested, you put your energies into things, into fantasy, you didn't really need it. So the thing that you really need, you don't throw out. I mean, like, you know what you really use, you got you. You can distinguish, you know, you look around a lot of stuff, you say, what the heck could I buy that for? This is not going to ever use it, I don't need it. And then, but you can't get rid of it, because that would admit that you really, right? But also, you're afraid maybe you will want it next week, you know, because that's the worst thing. If you give something away, and then you find out that the other person gets tremendous use out of it, loves it, and fantastic, and it feels sick. That's what happens. If you, a kid, will throw something out, he'll throw some toy out that he doesn't like, and this and that, and he puts it outside. And then, but he doesn't destroy it, like out in the garbage. Then never he comes along and takes it.
Oh,
next door. And then he plays it every day, and he gets tremendous. The kid will want it back. And like the whole thing. And then there'll be a whole dispute. Did you get,
but see, it's my thing, and you should, but you put it outside. Then you have to explain to the kid that once you put it outside, it doesn't belong to him anymore. But why will it suddenly be a problem? You see? Because that'll arouse the fantasy. Because the whole thing was just a fantasy. And he really doesn't have any true enjoyment out of it. But now that the other guy is enjoying it, suddenly it's, the fantasy is re-aroused. And he's afraid maybe he lost something.
Yeah,
or wants that.
It
has value. But the tzaddik doesn't have... really talking to time, it means to say that everything was eiskechashman, as they say. Everything was worked out. So he had exactly what he needed. And therefore, even the things that are small, but they had a place, they were vital, they were essential. Everything he had was essential. And that's why he kept his possessions in order. Now, if anybody, let's see if we can on this note, though. Does anybody have any hint, any clue as to what the reason is? I know what bothers you is that why, if it's a natural faculty and it requires perfection, would God prevent it? And what's the answer to that? The Malki says that there must be a necessity of prophecy. Good point. Except we made the point, you weren't here last week. We said that there is really different kinds of prophecy. We distinguished the two kinds of prophecy. We said, well, sometimes God has a prophetic message that God wants to convey to people, right? As most of the prophecies in the Torah, right? A specific message to convey to the Jewish people. Then there's a prophecy which is purely for the edification and the perfection of the prophet himself, even though it has no social purpose. For example, as we said, the Mashiach, right, will be a tremendous chacham and will be on the level of prophecy, but he won't have rights. As far as the nation is concerned, he won't play a role in his mission. He will not use prophecy to establish himself or to, you know, for any practical. So therefore, we see that prophecy exists even without a so-called practical purpose, but purely for the intellectual perfection of the individual. Yes?
Because I was thinking about Jeremiah, and he was the last prophet that had any following in the world, really. And maybe it was because the people were so horrible that they weren't worthy of a prophet.
Yeah, I mean, weren't worthy, but... But that could be, you see, that explains a given instance.
Yeah.
What you're saying explains a given instance. Right? But the way we understand the Rambam, it doesn't mean that God can intervene in a given instance. Right? It means that it's a constant thing. So why, of course. But that could be any time. Yeah?
You just said something that his father would be now with his
son. You know, if we see an illustration of the Rambam's position in the Chumash. Rambam's position is actually supported by a specific occurrence in the Torah, according to the interpretation of Rashi. Yeah, it's true that when he was in mourning he didn't prophesy. But that's not because God, that's because since he was in a state of mourning, he didn't have the proper the proper ability. Proper energy, whatever. I in one respect it's Jacob. And it's in Bereishis chapter 49. And Jacob called his children and said, "Gather around, and I will tell you what will occur to you in the end of days." Right? And he comes to, he says, "Gather together and listen, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father." Now, if you read on, you see, he never revealed to them what would happen to them in the end of days. He goes on, he forgot. Rashi says, "Bikesh legalos esakeh." He wanted to reveal the end, to give them a whole panorama. At this moment in his life, when he was about to withdraw from the scene, and he achieved that state of perfection and objectivity, so he had a vision. He saw the whole course of human history, and the ultimate the resolution and the redemption and the faith in the Mashiach, and he wanted to reveal to them. He wanted to reveal to them. V'nistarek imenu shechina. And the Shechina departed from him. The Hitzchol Omer, Vamacher. So God actually prevented it. And why? What's the reason? It would not have been different. In other words, it was essential. Each generation has to have a certain impetus to keep striving. To keep striving and improving and working and so forth. This knowledge would not have been good. This knowledge would have caused a certain stagnation.
So I think that this might be the clue, that prophecy is not so simple. Because, no. In other words, the man is supposed to operate. We have free will. We have free will. And,
against God's plan.
Yes, that's true. And our free will also has to operate in conjunction with God's plan. That's the point. And therefore, certain kinds of knowledge could be disastrous to God's plan. So that even though the capacity to obtain the knowledge is out there, not all knowledge is really, and that would answer your question too. It's true that knowledge is, but not all knowledge is really, man is not fit. Man is fit to obtain a certain amount of knowledge, a certain level of knowledge, and as we said before, certain types of knowledge can be harmful. So when you're entering into the prophetic, you've got to take into consideration many questions as to how it will affect the individual, how it will affect God's plan, and so forth. So that the God, in this case, Yaakov was ready. He had the vision. He was going to tell them. And then God took it away from him. So, because it would have been harmful. So that is, that would go a certain distance to explain the Rambam's position. That the veto power stems from the nature of prophecy, that this is something which can't always be allowed, to manifest itself. Could be many factors. It could be that this person will know prophecy because it could have a bad impact on him. The fact that he experiences prophecy might, even though he has all the records, the fact that a person has the faculty, have to say one thing. The fact that a person is perfected and he has a certain faculty does not mean to say that the actual experience could have certain negative effects upon him. The fact that he prophesies is possible, and therefore God doesn't want him to prophesy. Or it's possible in a given case. Here with Yaakov, it was a specific case. This particular prophecy, God didn't want him to enunciate. The God provoked him because of the particular. So it could be the guy, could be the person, could be the prophetic information, and so forth. I mean, it could be other things that we're not, we're just speculating over here, but the case of Yaakov is a good illustration.